Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Topp. I lost 135 pounds and drastically improved my whole family's health adopting a paleo lifestyle. My husband Matt, who happens to be the producer of this podcast, and I blog our recipes, successes, and struggles at paleoparents.com. Matt and I have authored two cookbooks, Eat Like a Dinosaur, a family-friendly recipe and guidebook for kids, and the upcoming Beyond Bacon, which is a paleo recipe book respecting the whole hog, nose to tail, due out in hardback July 2nd, 2013. We have a passion for family-friendly meals that are practical, affordable, and sustainable to the earth, as well as our long-term health.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne. I was a scientist before becoming a full-time stay-at-home mom and the blogger behind thepaleomom.com. I'm also the author of the upcoming book, The Paleo Approach, available for pre-order now off Amazon and due out September 28th, 2013. Both my blog and The Paleo Approach are heavily focused on the autoimmune protocol. I also blog about the practical application of the paleo diet and share wonderful recipes.
Next up, News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip.
Hi.
Hey, lady.
How's it going?
I'm recovering. How's it going for you?
I'm recovering too, but not from the same thing you're recovering from.
Maybe I should get our guest on here and we can talk about it.
Is she on?
No. Should I bring her on? Are you ready?
Yeah.
Everybody? So now we are joined by our guest this week. Arcy, can you introduce yourself? Tell our listeners about not just who you are, but your projects and why you're interested in our special topic today, which is going to be breastfeeding and first foods. But I don't want everyone who doesn't have a baby to run away, because we're definitely going to recap paleo effects and do a bunch of really cool stuff. So go ahead, Arcy.
All right. I'm Arcy. I write the paleo recipe and lifestyle blog, rubiesandradishes.com. And I recently published my first cookbook, The Paleo Slow Cooker.
Which is fantastic, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad you liked it. And I'm also, you know, that was a really good tool for me. And I think I heard you guys talking about this on the podcast with Julie from Paleo OMG. And the crock pot is such a good tool for people new to paleo and people that just have a busy lifestyle. But, and I'm also a mom of a 9-month-old, so yeah, first foods and breastfeeding are just really topics I'm really passionate about, so I'm excited to answer some questions today and share my experience with you, with the Paleo View listeners.
Cool.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on. We're excited. I know I actually kind of met you, quote-unquote, online not too long ago because I was actually searching on Amazon kind of in an obsessive way. I like to peruse Amazon for all upcoming paleo books. And I remember seeing the cover and was really, really impressed. And when I read the description of the book, I reached out to you and asked a couple of specific questions because I'd been disappointed with a different slow cooker paleo book, and was really, really impressed that your book, you know, doesn't use processed, canned, bottled kind of things in order to make the meals. And then when I actually got the book, even though you had told me that you didn't do those things, when I got the book and saw that you included recipes and ideas for basic things like coconut milk and broth, and you talk about the importance of nutrient density within the diet, I think for Sarah and I, those are the key components of our paleo lifestyle and what we try to encourage people to do. And so, you know, when you're working on something like a short cookbook, which is essentially what a slow cooker is, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I try to do a lot of braised foods because it's easier to digest, but oftentimes people, you know, take too many shortcuts. And I think you did a fantastic job of, figuring out where you could make cuts that would be beneficial to the time, but not necessarily sacrifice health, and then also focused on, you know, it's not a good idea to cut this corner because it's just not worth it kind of thing. So I think that's great. And I've heard a lot of people say that when they're testing the recipes that they've really liked them. I know we have a recipe review on our site. A recipe tester of mine really liked it. Matt and I aren't very good lately at other people's recipes just because we've been so busy and kind of doing what's familiar to us, but I'm looking forward to having a little more time and giving it a shot because, frankly, we need to slow cook more often too, and it's just, it's a tool that if you don't use it all the time, you're not quite sure how it's going to work and all that kind of stuff.
Right, right. Yeah, and the more you use it, just the easier it gets in the sense that you could just look in your fridge and see what you have and just, you know, you have a liquid and whatever vegetables and meat and you just throw it in and go to work. That's just kind of how we really got into the slow cooker when we first started following a paleo diet.
Cool. So do you guys want to grill me on PaleoFX?
Yeah. I want to find out, like, I certainly saw some Facebook updates and some tweets and it sounds like you guys were having an amazing time. Like just the photos and everything that was coming out of PaleoFX looked like I was totally missing out.
Yeah.
So
it wasn't. A lot of fun. All the time, these things, the best part of it is the social for me. Like,
oh yeah.
It's terrible to say, but I only attended one lecture each day, other than the ones that I was in. And it was kind of intentional because the last couple of these things that I've been to, my brain gets fried and I get overwhelmed. And then I just feel like I'm not energetic or enthusiastic about the rest of the trip if I do like lectures all day one day. And so I kind of picked the key ones that I wanted to attend and then hung out. It was a two-level event. The first level was called Expo, and the second level was like where the speakers were in several rooms. And so the Expo Center is where they had the cooking demos and where they had like all the vendors. And a lot of us were hanging out down there just because food bloggers, we all know each other, so when a cooking demo goes up, you want to like woo woo your friends in the audience, you know, and hang out down there. Not that I didn't also have friends on the panels. So we just did a lot of hanging out, and even when we weren't at the actual event, we took every opportunity to kind of socialize with one another. And the first night I got there, Abel James from Fat Burning Man actually lives in Austin, Texas, and he was so generous in opening up his home to pretty much anyone who wanted to come by. And George from Civilized Caveman Cooking Creations made this like epic meal, and I literally watched him cook for like 4 hours straight, and everyone just had a terrific time dining together. And you know, it's awesome to eat a meal that you don't have to worry about, and it's totally safe. And as the evening went on, people trickled in, and by the time the evening was over, we were like already just so enthusiastic to get the weekend started and just kind of continued that way, eating our way through Austin and hanging out. There's a local place there called Lick, which serves coconut milk ice cream, and that's pretty awesome. Although the sweeteners were not what I would normally use for a sweetener, so of course I woke up with like nasty hangover the next day. But yeah. So I was on two panels. I was on the Cave Kids is what I think they called it. And that panel included Chris Kresser, Emily Deans, Sarah Fragoso, and Melissa. I can't remember what her last name is. Pellegrino? I hope I'm saying that right. If I didn't, I'll smack myself later. But she's a trainer for kids. She has a mommy me kind of class. Cool. And coaches all the way up to, you know, when they're older. Anyway, so that was kind of cool, but it's also a topic that I talk about all the time, so I'm a little bit like wah, wah. You know, like I feel like I'm telling people the same thing over and over again, and I know it's new for them, but to me, I'm like, oh, haven't you guys heard me say this already? Am I boring you? I'm sorry, blah, blah, blah. And then the second panel was a Journey of Transformation panel, which I think originally was intended to be like, look at all these people and the transformation that they've made. Let's talk about how awesome that is. But when Tony Federico, the moderator, sent all of us questions, it was fascinating how every single one of us wanted to talk about something a little different about Journey of Transformation. Mm-hmm. And of course, mine ended up being what we talk about often on here. Specifically, I think we kind of kicked that off with Stephanie Ruper being on a couple of times, but really focusing on health instead of weight loss and the huge emotional transformation that you have to make, not just physical, when you undergo a lifestyle change and specifically drastic appearance change.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting. You know, Jimmy and I both had similar experiences, kind of Jimmy being, I think he said he was over 400 pounds, me being 336 pounds. We both kind of talked about how it feels like to not even be looked at or appreciated, or people don't make eye contact with you. People don't hold the door open for you. Like, you're literally a non-human. And then suddenly you lose a certain amount of weight and you look normal, and then you become a human and people treat you in a way that makes you realize that you weren't treated right from the get-go, and mm-hmm. how crazy emotionally disturbing.
Like when you suddenly hit the weight where people start flirting with you?
Yeah, well, that's a whole nother thing altogether.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I got flirted with, I was like, I don't know if Matt was in the car, he was with me, but not like with me, but I remember saying to him, I totally just got flirted with.
Yeah, no, I remember it too. Like, I remember the, like, okay.
What just happened?
I'm getting somewhere.
Yeah.
I look flirtable. Sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think, you know, specifically Jimmy and I were talking more like, you end up sometimes feeling like, oh, if this is how I'm being treated now, then because no one would hold the door open for me, because they wouldn't even acknowledge that I existed, and they wouldn't make eye contact with me in an elevator, and no one would say, hello, how are you, and smile. Just basic human right kind of feelings. When you get to a certain place where they start doing that, then you kind of look back and think of how badly you were treated, and it's like this big emotional struggle with, you know, dealing with those demons sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then George Bryant, Civilized Caveman, was also on the panel, who, I don't know if everyone knows this, but he's discussed before, I think on Stephanie Ruper's podcast as well as on his blog, that he was bulimic for a very long time, and that, you know, he used paleo as kind of a justification to over-exercise and do that sort of thing, and he had to overcome his own disordered eating. And I talked about overcoming disordered eating both from, you know, being bulimic as a teenager and then dealing with the repercussions with getting help for the purging but not getting help for the binging, and, you know, what that kind of does of a lifetime of disordered eating. Now, as you and I have talked about, like, I can't do Whole30s anymore. I can't even tell myself that I'm strict AIP because it brings about disordered eating for me. I can't take pictures of every meal. I just can't do those sort of things because I need to just relax about my food, or else I become neurotic, and then I either am orthorexic or I'm binging, or, you know, I find myself just not exhibiting healthy relationship with food behaviors. So it was a really, I think, fascinating panel. And I tried to really focus on people, you know, finding their health and being happy with who they are, and, you know, de-stressing and really prioritizing the things that matter in life, not a number on a scale. And I felt good about what I said, but at the same time, it's also not a very popular message in paleo. I mean, I think it's becoming more acceptable maybe in the last year, but it's not like something that people are willing to admit. And it's not something that a lot of people aren't willing to say, that quite a few paleo people are using paleo as justification for orthorexia or whatever the case may be. And so the fact that it's getting out there, I feel good about, but I also was kind of nervous, like, oh, maybe people came to this panel to, like, get, you know, pink butterflies and fuzzy boas or something. That's not exactly what we delivered. I think a lot of us talked about how intense that journey can be and how to focus and prioritize because of it. And so anyway, afterwards, I must have had half a dozen more, maybe, teary-eyed women come up and just ask for a hug from me and say how much not just that panel, but our podcast inspires them, and how much better they feel about themselves and their own journey to health because of the message that we're sharing. And so it was moments like that where I really wished you were there, Sarah. Like, I wish I was there to, like, hold your hand and give a group hug to these women who were just like, yeah. Tell Sarah I said hi. Tell Sarah
oh,
we miss her.
So sweet.
Yeah. Sometimes really, they would say, tell Stacy I said hi, because they get us confused.
Yeah. I know. Well, I think that, I mean, like, I can tell the difference between our voices when I listen to the podcast, but partly because I know what I said and I know what you said. I think we sound very similar, and I think we have enough, like, crossover in our, like, personal stories that it can be a little confusing for people. I don't blame them for getting us mixed up. That's
no,
what I'm gonna say.
It's cute. It's not at all frustrating. But, yeah, so if people are interested in checking that out, which I would highly recommend, I don't know if you can choose to watch specific panels or if you're going to have to kind of do the whole shebang, but I do know that Paleo Magazine sponsored the live feeds, which I tried to share with people so that they could participate earlier when it was happening. So I know that it's been recorded, and my understanding is that they're going to put those feeds up on the web for people to purchase in addition to what they did last year, which is like a whole box DVD set, which is pretty expensive. So what I'm hoping is that if there are certain presentations or panels that people were interested in, like Chris Kresser's Gut Brain Access or the Women's Health panel, which I attended and were both fantastic, I would suggest that they look into and keep in touch with therealpaleofx.com so that they can stream that stuff, and both of my panels will be on there, and I would love to hear what people think about those panels if they're watching them and weren't there in person, because I think it's a different experience to be among the crowd and talk and get a sense of what everybody thought versus how it would translate maybe online in and of itself. So,
well, I, even though I felt like I was missing out, I was right at a very critical deadline for my book. And I did actually finish writing part one over the weekend. So,
yay.
I know. Well, part
you
one
sound
is
so much better.
I know. Well, so part one is the vast majority of the science. And it's certainly, it's the vast majority of the stuff that's challenging the borders of what I know. So there's a lot of things that I've had to, you know, look up completely or double check or find the scientific references for it. So it was really challenging writing, and it's probably going to end up being about half the book. So it was like the hardest part of the book to write. I also think the most important, because I really think that explaining the science behind how diet and lifestyle affects autoimmune disease is it's the whole point. Like, the whole point of the book is to explain people why it's important. And so it's really been, I'm clearly putting a lot of pressure on myself to get it right. Because I think that if I do get it right, which I'm editing now and I'm really happy reading what it's so long, I don't remember what I wrote. So it's kind of like reading a book, I'm sort of dissociated from the fact that I wrote it, because I'm reading stuff that I wrote months ago now. And as I'm editing, I'm going like, all right, this is good. Okay. I can this is understandable. And this is a good, you know, level of explanation, very, very similar level of explanation to the explanations I give, on any science topic with my blog posts, except that it's longer. So, it's really helped just my, feeling of being able to handle things. Like, it's just like, I feel like, okay, this really hard part is done. And yes, the next month and a half are going to be really, really busy to get the rest of the book done. But, you know, the hard part is over, and it is such a good feeling. So I do feel a lot better. I'm still having some clearly physical reactions to the stress level of the last couple weeks that I'm just trying to go to bed earlier and spend more time outside and try and recover a little bit, because I don't think I can't maintain that stress level for the next month and a half. So I need to kind of recoup a little bit. But I really felt like I was missing out, but I sort of stand by my choice to stay home and focus on the book, because I think in the grand scheme of things, that will have been a more important use of my time this year. I will go next year.
Yes, and I did tell everyone that you would be at AHS.
Yeah.
And I gave an affirmative on being your date, so I guess that's going to happen.
Oh, you want to come to the speaker's dinner with me?
Yeah, I'll be your date.
That's awesome.
I'm good arm candy.
Home with the kids. Who am I going to bring?
No problem.
Oh, we're going to have so much fun.
Arcy?
Yes.
What do you think about all this?
I mean, I love following your Instagram feed on PaleoFX. It was so much fun to see what you guys were up to, and I really hope to be there next year as well.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, you know, Kelly from Spunky Coconut came with her daughter, who's young, but I do know it was hard for her. You know, at one point, poor Ginger was just so tired. Wow. And Kelly's trying to finish her coconut milk ice cream and enjoy it, and Ginger's just like, "Wanna go home, mama?" You know, and it was like, oh.
Yeah, I saw the pictures of her and her carrier taking naps. And
yeah,
I think if we come next year, we will come as a family, and my husband could take care of the baby. So
yeah,
enjoy the conference.
When I heard that Nom Nom Paleo, what I call the Nom Bomb family, when I heard Michelle and Henry were going as a family, I thought they were crazy. And I was like, no way. I'm really excited. It's just Matt and I, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, I got home, and as great of a job as their uncle did, it's like 4 or 5 days of essentially a free for all, even though it was a free for all with things that were in our home. And he's very respectful of our lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Evidently the kids just ate fruit and caveman cookies all day long. And so they were a bit, and I don't think they slept as much or as well as when we're home and we put them to bed early and all that kind of stuff. And we came home yesterday and the house is a mess and the kids were like, who are these children? They're not our children. They were just crazy. And I started thinking, like, you know what? Maybe Michelle and Henry had a good thing going, because Henry took the kids to, like, the Children's Museum, and there's all kinds of really cool things to do in Austin that Matt probably would have enjoyed doing more than attending the conference, because he's not really a social person. But he did say that he had a fantastic time, and meeting and hanging out with friends and doing the after-dinner stuff is great. He just gets kind of overwhelmed with crowds. So I think, frankly, what Michelle and Henry ended up doing would have worked well for us as well. But ultimately, you know, we're super glad that we went. We had a great time. I was just learning the finesse of how to do this with a family. And, like, I have a full-time job. It's not like, you know, it was a big deal for me to take off basically a whole week from work and do all that kind of stuff. And, of course, every evening I had to get back online and do a little bit of my regular day job, because it's not the kind of thing I can just completely walk away from. So it's a little bit overwhelming and tired when we got home yesterday. And frankly, I'm surprised that I've got my stuff together today, because the 24 hours between when we left and now, our car got towed in Austin. Like, the hotel parking lot had us towed. And they were like, oh, we're sorry about that. And they released the car, but we still had to, like, get a ride from super sweet Danielle at Against All Grain to, like, get us to the towed car and then pick me up. And it made us late for the farm to table dinner. Which was just like, it kind of started the whole night off wrong for us. Like, it was hard for us to just be happy and comfortable after going through that whole thing.
Yeah.
And then Kelly texted us that her bag had been stolen by a homeless man as she was trying to get home. And then when we got home, our kids were crazy. And then we realized that TSA had kept my laptop. Like, they didn't, first of all, they took Matt to third base thinking that my Love Bean Fudge was a bomb, evidently. And they stole my Love Bean Fudge. And then
they didn't even give it back.
No, they decided that it was totally not okay. And I was like, whatever.
What?
It was crazy. And they took apart the whole bag and they put him aside in, like, this bullpen arena that was really creepy, and gave him, like, you know, a million questions. And I appreciate that they're making sure that we're all safe, but the Love Bean Fudge was legitimate Love Bean Fudge. It wasn't anything scary. Ultimately, we were so rattled by the whole thing that when they gave us all of our stuff back, we didn't realize that they didn't give us my laptop. And we were just like, okay, let's get out of here. And when I got home and went to like get ready for work, and my work laptop wasn't here. It was really freaky. Ooh. So the past 24 hours have just been like major stress. I was basically having a panic attack this morning. I think maybe it was like a gluten cross reaction, because I don't usually react to stress that dramatically unless I've had some gluten. So it could be a combination of just like traveling and bad food and cross reaction and then a stressful situation. But this morning I was just a wreck. And so I called TSA. They have my laptop. They're going to mail it to me. It's all going to be fine. I came home. The kids had gotten a good night's sleep. They had eaten healthy meals today and they were wonderful. And we read books before bedtime. And now I'm sitting here with carrot cake that we made and a hot cup of tea, and it's 26 minutes into the show already, but I'm like, now I'm ready to start. I'm okay. Now I'm ready to talk about cute little babies who need to nurse.
Well, then I guess we should do a show.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
Today for Science with Sarah, because we are talking about pregnancy and babies and life with babies, I thought actually it would be a really good topic to talk about napping. We talk about sleep a lot on the show, and you know, we've really talked about just how important getting adequate sleep is for health. But one of the things that happens late in pregnancy, when it becomes more difficult to get comfortable when you're sleeping, and then once you have a newborn and you have the needs of a baby waking you up every few hours all night for months, you know, our it doesn't matter how much you prioritize sleep at that point, you're not getting enough. And there's lots of ways that different families figure out ways to improve nighttime sleep, and that those are all personal choices. And I think that really depends on your personality, your relationship with your husband, your baby's personality, you know, how you handle nighttime wakings. But I really want to talk about the whole concept of sleep when the baby sleeps and whether or not that's actually beneficial. And the reason why I want to talk about that is because there are a number of articles in magazines or websites that will tell you that napping is actually detrimental, and that if you nap during the day, you won't sleep as deeply when you go to sleep at night. So when you look at the scientific research into napping, it really follows sort of two basic types of research. There's a lot of research done in elderly people to sort of understand why elderly people tend to nap more and choose to nap more. And then there's a lot of research being done in insomniacs and trying to understand why people have insomnia. And those are actually sort of really good ways of looking at the benefits or detrimental effects of napping, because that gives you sort of the extreme cases to look at. And when you design a scientific study, you can usually tease out what's going on better if you're looking at a slightly extreme circumstance. So one of the problems, though, is that people have done these sort of correlative studies and looked at, you know, whether or not you nap and whether or not you have health issues. And there's been a really strong correlation formed between napping and type 2 diabetes. I mean, to the point where you'll find that on these websites, they'll say, you know, don't nap because it increases your risk of type 2 diabetes. There's a really strong correlation between napping and insomnia. And people say, don't nap because it'll give you insomnia. The problem is, of course, with correlative studies is you cannot separate out cause and effect. And it's far more likely that people whose bodies have, you know, are insulin resistant, are likely cortisol resistant, have likely leptin resistance, and all of these hormones that affect the immune system, and all of these hormones that also interact with the
hypothalamic pituitary axis, which is the cortisol, stress response axis. It also is an important regulator of circadian rhythms. All of these things that are happening in type 2 diabetes are also disrupting, hormones that are supposed to help you sleep at night and help you be awake during the day. So napping is more likely a symptom of developing type 2 diabetes. And the same with insomnia. If you have insomnia at night and you're not sleeping well, you're tired during the day and you're more likely to fall asleep at an inappropriate time or more likely to choose to go have a nap. So it's more recognized in sort of the recent medical literature that napping is a symptom of bad sleep at night, not the cause of bad sleep at night. And actually, there's been some really interesting studies done in elderly people that have looked at the effects of napping at different times of day and different length naps and how that affects quality and quantity of nighttime sleep. And what they have found is that, people who are choosing to take naps, the naps are typically an hour and a half long, and it doesn't matter what time of day it is. Even if it's within 2 hours of going to bed, it has no effect on the quality or quantity of nighttime sleep. There are some other studies that show almost the same thing, that having a nap during the day will decrease the length of time that you spend sleeping at night, but that your 24-hour sleep time, the amount of time that you spend asleep over the full 24 hours of the day, is actually increased. There seems to be a relationship between sleep stage during your nap and the duration of your nighttime sleep. And this is because if your nap is long enough for you to spend any time in a deep sleep, what is called a shortwave sleep, that's either stage 3 or stage 4 sleep. These are sort of all names for the same thing. Basically means deep sleep. Then your need for deep sleep at night is typically not as great. And so that can actually shorten your nighttime sleep, even though it increases your 24-hour sleep. There's some really interesting studies that look at short naps. So naps that are typically 10 to 30 minutes. And those are short enough naps that you spend the entire nap in either stage 1 or stage 2 sleep, which are the lightest stages of sleep. So you start in stage 1, you get a little bit deeper, that's stage 2, you get a little deeper, that's stage 3, you get really deep in that stage 4. Stage 5 sleep is dreaming sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. And that's kind of a separate thing because you can jump into that from different sleep stages. But so for a short nap, you spend the majority of that nap in a lighter sleep, stage 1 and stage 2. And they've actually shown that as long as you spend 3 minutes in stage 2 sleep, so that actually is as short as an 8-minute nap, because stage 1 lasts anywhere between 5 and 10 minutes. As long as you spend 3 minutes in stage 2 sleep, they can actually measure that nap is a restorative nap. They give volunteers these sort of cognitive challenge tests after being woken up at certain lengths of time into their sleep, and they can actually tell that 3 minutes in stage two sleep, a 10-minute nap, is actually restorative, and that length of sleep, because you're not spending any time in deep sleep, has no effect on the duration of your nighttime sleep. But if you're talking about having a newborn baby, you don't need to be limiting your naps to 30 minutes to avoid that deep sleep, because you're not going to be getting enough deep sleep during your night anyway. So if your naps are 30 minutes or longer, then you're going to be getting that deep sleep. And that's going to be that deep sleep is the really healing sleep. And it's very, very important for our brains to get that very deep sleep. So aiming for a nap that is over 30 minutes will give you that deep sleep, and that will help to bring your 24-hour total of sleep up higher. So what these studies really show is that there's benefits to napping. There's benefits to short naps because it can revive you and refresh you and can actually improve your cognitive function so that you can actually do stuff. The longer naps where you get some deep sleep will help make up for sleep deficits that you're not getting at night. So really, You know, there's other things that you can do to help protect your circadian rhythms, like spending time outside during the day, making sure that lights stay off when you're up at night. If you have any night lights to help you see, make sure they're red lights. But the whole philosophy of napping when the baby nappings is completely valid, and getting sleep, especially if you have any health challenges, making sure that sleep is a priority in those early months after having a baby is really important. Was that a lot of science?
Yeah, I just did it because it felt right.
that's true too.
I'm good. RC, you have any thoughts?
No, I mean, I slept a lot when I was home on maternity leave. Like you said, it just felt right. You're so exhausted from being up at night.
Yeah, that's what I did too.
Why? Cool. I don't know why anyone would not sleep. Like if you're tired. We'll talk about rhythms and following your instincts and stuff like that, but it's always what I'm going to recommend with babies, breastfeeding or not, you know, like biologically you're driven to want to do something for a reason. And if you're tired, you should probably sleep. Cool?
Cool.
I think you've got some questions for us. I don't have to actually say them this week.
That means I don't have to answer them, right?
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope.
All right, first question is from Bree from Larkspur, California. Hi, love the podcast. My question is about paleo and galactologs. I'm nursing my third baby, a voracious five-month-old. He is a terrific nurser, but as with my twins, my milk supply is not so great. I pump frequently to boost supply, and I'm also on multiple herbs, fenugreek, blessed thistle, brewer's yeast, goat's rue, fennel, nettle. Even so, I'm barely holding even with his appetite. I'm going back 2 weeks, and I'm nervous about how the separation from the baby plus stress will affect supply. I did a Whole 30 in August and loved it. I'm very interested in permanently going paleo. However, my milk supply dropped during the Whole 30, I think because I was losing weight too quickly, 2 pounds per week. To stop the supply drop, I'm going back to true paleo. Our nursing relationship is my first priority, but I'm sad not to be losing weight and not eating only what I believe are the best foods for health. I'd love to be able to eat paleo while maintaining supply. Here's my question. I get a supply from oatmeal and barley, but they are obviously not paleo. Do you know of any food galactologs that are paleo, or do you have advice on my dilemma of paleo versus supply?
Well, yes, Bree, I do know of some, and I do have some advice. I actually have a recipe on my site for grain-free lactation cookies, which includes many those. What that means is foods that promote milk supply increase. So let's just call them that, because I'm not the PhD. Interestingly enough, nuts also perform that function the same way that oatmeal does. So specifically, nuts high in omega-3 will help, as well as anise and fennel and a bunch of other things that we've specifically listed out in the post that Matt will put in the show notes. I want to address, though, the questions about weight loss and supply dropping, because I think, you know, it's really important that we do pay attention to our supply. But there's a couple of factors going on that women need to be aware of. And first and foremost, that paleo is not a low-carb diet. I think for a lot of people, going lower in carb is very good. But when the average American is eating anywhere from 300 to 500 grams of carbs a day, moving to 150 grams of carbs for a nursing mom is what I would still consider low carb. I mean, would you agree with me there, Sarah?
Yeah. No, I would say the number one thing that I typically recommend when people are experiencing milk supply issues when they go paleo is that they're not eating enough carbohydrates.
Yeah. Well, I think eating enough in general is also very important.
Yeah.
I know for for me personally, I was super hungry, and I with my first two, I had oversupply, and that was a blessing and a curse, because on one hand, I never had to worry about supply. In fact, I think we've joked before, we made cheese, we tried to make soap, we did some crazy stuff with my breast milk because we had no more freezer space for it at one point with Cole. With Finn, we actually found a child in need to donate the milk to, which was fantastic. And then with Wesley, what was interesting is that when I was eating a balanced, healthful, nutrient-dense paleo diet, all of a sudden this oversupply that had been, you know, so problematic for me, giving me mastitis and all kinds of things with my first two, keeping in mind I had breastfed for 4 years already at that point and had this struggle all along, suddenly when I was paleo with Wesley, had absolutely no problems with milk supply. My body literally created exactly the amount that he needed, which made Matt and I feel really paranoid because we had gotten used to having a large stash and feeling really comfortable with always having stuff in the freezer. But it was fascinating that once my hormones were regulated from eating a nutrient-dense diet and, you know, calming itself down from all the problems that had created oversupply to begin with, I no longer had that issue. I do want to emphasize, though, that I was paying attention to my supply. I never restricted calories. I never restricted carbohydrates. I never restricted fat. I never restricted protein. I ate what I wanted to eat in a balanced supply. I made sure that I was getting plenty of vegetables and plenty of nutrient-dense foods. I wish I had been eating more organ meats in the beginning. That wasn't something that we picked up right away, but that's typical for most paleo people. Mm-hmm. That's not something that you're comfortable with. Don't jump into that, but it is a really good nutrient-dense food that you could add if you're comfortable with it. But you don't need to, A, not lose weight in order to have good supply, but B, you're absolutely correct that weight loss is not the priority, that it is your job as a mother right now to sustain the human being that you've brought into this world. And my personal opinion is that the prioritization is on feeding and nourishing that baby human, not a sort of vanity about appearance. Now, I would argue that if you have a lot of weight to lose and you're eating a healthy, balanced, nutrient-dense diet, you're going to both nourish that human being as well as lose weight, because that's what I did. The most weight that I lost was while I was nursing. I was burning extra calories. So even though I was eating a lot more, gosh, I miss being able to eat as much as I could when I was nursing, I was still losing a ton of weight because I was burning it while I was nursing. So yeah, that's my thought on that. RC, do you...
I think you gave such a comprehensive answer, Stacey, that the only thing I would add is, of course, the quantity of milk is very important, but Brie can also focus on the quality of milk. Sally Fallon's latest book, she talks about the study that showed that protein and immunoglobulin levels didn't vary based on mother's diet, but the fat composition did in the breast milk. So healthy fats in the diet can help the milk be more filling and more nutrient dense. So maybe Brie could focus on the fat content, focusing on eating a fatty fish, meat, organ meats if she's doing that. Butter and ghee if she tolerates that. So I think healthy fats could really help. And they also could help improve the DHA content of the breast milk. And she said that her supply is low, and it seems like her son might be eating solids soon, because I think she said he's about 5 months. So the other thing I would say is when he starts eating solids, to really start including some of the nutrient-dense foods like egg yolks, liver, bone broth, which I'm sure we'll get into some of the later questions. But I think that might help get some good nutrients and calories into his diet as well once he's ready to eat solids.
You say you didn't have anything to add, but that was fantastic. Oh. Sarah's like, now I've got nothing.
Yeah, I know. I don't have anything.
Come on, sunlight and sleep. You got it.
Oh, sunlight and sleep. Did I not just say that? Did I not just do an entire Science with Sarah about sleep? Sunlight, sleep, and how about hydration? Because I think that it's maybe something missed. Is that being adequately hydrated is really important for maintaining milk supply. And of course, your body will prioritize feeding your baby much more easily if your body feels like it is getting the basic necessities that it needs. So we've already talked about nutrition, but that also includes, sunlight and sleep.
And she mentioned it, but I want to call it out just to make sure that it doesn't get lost. Bree mentions that she realizes that stress affects her supply. And I would say that was definitely a factor for me. And I would also say that the best way to combat that is not just sleep, but one of the things, I think it was the week before last that we talked about, really engaging your spouse. You know, she doesn't say what's going on, but I think definitely even having, you know, skin-to-skin contact is also something we missed, but can be really soothing and relaxing for mother and baby. And often just one day skin-to-skin in bed, nothing else, no clothes, just mom, baby, and, you know, anybody else who wants to join, but mom and baby skin-to-skin all day long, whether it's on the sofa or in bed or in a sling, just literally chest-to-chest, can create a very beneficial boost in the breast milk. And that is mainly controlled by nothing other than mother sense, you know, whether that's biologically driven from what
it
we're
is
smelling.
Actually, I actually was reading papers about this for my book, and it's actually that physical contact boosts oxytocin.
Yeah. And so that's what I was going to say is like that it's releasing the stress and it's allowing the mom to reconnect with the baby, whatever that driver is, it totally makes sense that it's oxytocin on the back end. Whatever that front driver is, skin to skin is one of the best ways to immediately boost supply. And especially, you know, for women who are going back to work, I know for me, as soon as I got home from work, like my entire clothing on the upper half of my body went off and I stayed with the baby for as long as it took until the baby was satisfied. And sometimes that was 2 hours. I mean, sometimes it was 20 minutes. But it's really important to let your baby connect with you, especially if you've been away from them all day. So maybe those could help as well as the nutrition stuff.
Stacey, are you a lactation consultant in your day job? You know so much about this stuff.
I know. I really, really am passionate about it. We've talked – this is actually – is this our third breastfeeding show?
No, it's our second, but I think it
I think I sneak it in all the time.
Because we've done a few like kid-centric shows, and we've done a couple of pregnancy shows, so I think it's yes. You sneak it in.
Yeah, I just totally. I'm really, really passionate about it. Before I was really into paleo, it was my hobby. I was a
breastfeeding people?
Yeah. I was a part of a La Leche League group for pretty much, 6 years? And knew as much or more than some of the leaders in the group, but chose not to be a leader because you're limited by what you could say. And so, like, I went through the process and then decided I didn't want to be formally tied to La Leche League International, which is a fantastic group. And part of the reason that they ask you not to say personal things is so that women who aren't comfortable with me, a mother who breastfed for 2 years, they don't take what you're saying and then say, never mind, I won't listen to anything else that she has to say. So anyway, I chose to just participate as a active member and librarian and all that kind of stuff for years, attended every single meeting, arranged meetups. And I was really, really passionate about it. I donated milk with Finn. So I got really involved in the scene in order to find a worthwhile child because my milk was dairy free. So I wanted to make sure I found a baby who would benefit from going dairy free. And, I also cloth diapered from the beginning. I made my kids baby food. Like they've never had a jarred baby food. There are just things that instinctually were really important to me. And I think that crunchy mama mindset totally brought me to paleo rather than like paleo bringing me to the crunchy mindset, which I think is what's happening to a lot of the younger CrossFit women and moms who then become mothers. Like it's the opposite for me, you know? Did I just ramble for no reason at all?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I get asked that question a lot about breastfeeding though. So I feel like now I can just like point to this podcast and say, right. There you go.
I thought it was really interesting because I listened to your past podcast and I noticed that you knew just so much. You knew as much as lactation nurses that I've met with, if not more. So I was actually curious if your line of work was involved with that.
Absolutely not. No. No. No, 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 no.
It's just a hobby.
It's just a hobby. And I love helping women succeed because I have such a passion for it that I'm like, whatever it takes, I'll give you any answer you want. I will sit there and I don't know how many babies I've watched latch on and then helped. You know, like I just, it's my bag. Okay. Sorry, Sarah.
It's a career backup plan. All right.
Totally. In case my first career in this paleo thing doesn't work out, I'll just become an LC.
Walking an author thing on top of daytime job. Okay, so our next question is from Sarah from Syracuse, New York. First, thank you for your show. I find it very helpful to have on in the background as I cook and clean and as I glean wonderful words of wisdom from you both. That's when I listen to the podcast, too. I am a 30-year-old mother of two darling boys who are 5 months and 2 years old. My family has been mostly paleo for the past 3 to 4 years, and my 2-year-old has been completely paleo since birth. I'm currently breastfeeding both of my sons, and my younger son is not on any solids and only breast milk. Since his birth, I have had a significant problem with something called oversupply. Basically, I produce a lot of milk, too much milk, so much that I am getting clogged ducts leading to mastitis, etc. We have ruled out other factors for oversupply, including tongue tie, the effects of tandem nursing, etc. At this time, the specialist I'm working with wants to pursue food allergies as the reason for oversupply. I was shocked. Shocked. I'm already gluten, soy, dairy, mostly sugar-free, and she mentioned eggs and almonds as I eat a ton of these. I'm about to start a 2-month elimination diet of eggs, goat's cheese, and almond flour, eggs, nuts. My question, my research and understanding of leaky gut is mostly that these allergies would develop if we are not attempting to repair our gut. Is it likely that I would develop an egg allergy at this point if I have been doing gut work for the past several years?
So, Sarah, do you want to answer the question that yes, she could, because she's been consuming those problems, she may never have healed her gut all along, before we jump into the how to solve oversupply?
Yes. So one of the possibilities is that her gut never completely healed. The other possibility actually is that eggs themselves, there's a protein in egg white called lysozyme, and it's part of the egg's defense against microbial attack. Lysozyme is a enzyme that lyses, which means it cuts proteins apart. And it also does a cool thing in that it globs together with other proteins or protein fragments. And it turns out that lysozyme is very, very good at getting across the gut barrier intact. So even if you have a fairly healthy gut, egg white proteins can cross the gut barrier. And of course, immediately across the gut barrier is 80% of your immune system. So egg allergies are actually fairly common for that reason. So it's possible that it's sort of independent of gut health, and it's just that when you eat a lot of eggs, you increase the probability of those proteins crossing the gut barrier and interacting with the immune system and developing an allergy. With nuts, it's actually a slightly different mechanism. Nuts are very high in phytic acid, or more specifically, the salts of phytic acid, which are called phytate. And these can actually inhibit digestive enzymes. And so through the inhibition of digestive enzymes, your body will actually secrete more digestive enzymes to compensate. And this causes an imbalance because what happens is it's like certain kinds of digestive enzymes are inhibited, but others aren't. And when you get those imbalances in digestive enzymes, you can actually digest your own gut basically. So high phytate foods, and almonds are very high in phytates, can actually cause a leaky gut
that way. If you're eating a lot, I mean, this is one of those things that it's really dose dependent. And phytates are also anti-carcinogenic. So they've got like these other great properties if you eat them in moderate amounts. So depending on how much almonds and other high phytate foods, because there's phytates basically in all plant-based foods, that could be what's happening. And also nuts are highly allergenic again. So even if you're getting a little bit across the gut barrier, that could be what's going on. And other things can cause a leaky gut that are completely unrelated to diet. So, you know, not getting enough sleep, having unmanaged stress, all of those things can, those are lifestyle things that are completely unrelated to diet that do cause the junctions between the cells that line your gut to open up. So there's research that shows that cortisol, the stress hormone, causes the junctions between your cells to open up. And that's probably some adaptive part of the fight or flight reflex that, you know, prepared our bodies, activated our immune systems and prepared our bodies for healing from some injury after being mauled by a lion. It's probably a normal thing, but it's not something that you're supposed to have happen chronically. All of the stress responses that we have are designed for, you know, short duration acute stress, at the end of which you're either safe or you're dead. I mean, that's what our bodies are sort of designed for. That's the sort of chronic stress of being stuck in traffic and having deadlines and getting your kids to school on time. And those are not things that our bodies are designed to handle very well. So even, you know, life with young kids can be stressful, and that might have caused a leaky gut and be causing these food sensitivities. There's lots of reasons why it could happen. And definitely I think that it's, makes sense as a possible cause. And so, and as a person who also can't eat those foods, I understand dreading doing elimination diets to look at that. But also as somebody who knows the difference between how I feel when I don't eat those foods and how I feel when I do eat those foods, like getting foods out of your diet that you are sensitive to does make a really big difference to how you feel. So, that's kind of a crappy answer because she still has to do it. But that.
Well, the bonus thing for me when I eliminated, cause I mean, I started paleo because I had to eliminate dairy, and that's how I found paleo to begin with. So I had eliminated dairy, with my first, I eliminated dairy and chocolate with my second. And then with my third, I went clean paleo, and ended up going AIP after Wesley had weaned. But, the bonus for me was how much better the kids felt. And, you know, maybe not your oldest, you might not see a difference, but a 5 month old would, you're definitely going to see an improvement in, their digestive function. If your breast milk has allergies that you're allergic to in it, you're passing along that in the breast milk to them. So they might not have egg or nut allergies, but like, because I was lactose intolerant, my body was not able to properly process lactose and casein when I was breastfeeding. Little did I know, also gluten and all those things. And so it wasn't properly doing what it needed to do to those foods in my body in order for it to not pass through as incompletely broken down or whatever the case may be to the baby. And so then, you know, my baby's always had colic and bad diapers and didn't really sleep so great and spit up. Blah, 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 blah. All the things that are completely normal with most babies these days. So if you're seeing that in your, specifically your 5-month-old, it would be another sign that you have food allergies. I would say that going clean paleo totally helped my oversupply. You know, I mentioned that earlier, but there are other ways to deal with it other than eliminating foods. If you're either unable or overwhelmed by it and it ends up causing you to rebound, or even just in partnership with a diet change, I would strongly recommend looking into block feeding and to pumping. I know that pumping is going to create your body's mechanism to have more milk, But if you're getting clogged ducts and mastitis, honestly, it's easier just to have an extra pumping session, in my opinion, than to deal with the pain and issues with the associated health problems with oversupply. So for me personally, I had two extra pumping sessions a day that were specifically to alleviate oversupply. And it was really tough getting up in the middle of the night to pump because my baby was asleep at that point, but I was still pumping because otherwise I would wake up in the morning with clogged ducts or, you know, be on my way to mastitis or something. So I would look into that. And I would also, if you haven't already, I'm sure if you've got a 2-year-old, you're familiar with it. If not, definitely check out block feeding, which essentially means that you only feed from one side of your body for a certain block of time, whether that be 2 hours or 4 hours. And what that does is it allows the hind milk from that breast to get into the baby and for your breast to fully empty. What might be happening is that your baby is only getting foremilk, which is that thin milk on the top. And then if they get full and you're only 3/4 of the way through that breast, and then the next time they eat, you put them on the other breast and they only get foremilk, then you're not allowing your breast to fully empty, which also is your body's cue to stop making so much milk or to make more milk, is it has to fully empty for your body to get that cue. So when the baby gets hungry again, if you put it back to breast on the one that you fed originally on, then it understands to give the hind milk and to fully empty the breast. And then it knows, oh, it took 2 feedings to get through this breast. And a lot of women experience improvement just by block feeding. I mean, within a week. So that might help you regulate your milk as well. I just said regulate instead of regulate. So I'm going to address that. I realized that was improper. Arcee, have you ever had this problem?
Actually, I did. Yeah, I did have an oversupply issue early on, and the block feeding is what really helped me. But the only other comments I'd want to make is about cutting out the eggs. And if you're a nursing mom or a breastfeeding mom, I mean, those are the same thing. If you're a pregnant mom or a nursing mom and you need to cut out eggs, I think it's even more important than to consume liver. And this is because eggs are a great source of choline, and choline is really important for brain development, for liver function, as well as the nervous system. And a lot of studies have shown that on average, the population doesn't eat an optimal amount of choline, but it's even more important when you're pregnant or breastfeeding. And this is because the nutrients get depleted from the mom's body. So she needs to put those back in for the baby and for herself. So, and although it's in some vegetables, liver and egg yolk are the most important or the strongest sources.
Don't you just love that? You have another pro organ meat eater on the show.
So. You know, I grew up eating organ meats, and I've noticed people that haven't had them in childhood, I think it's a lot harder. So I totally, because my husband, I can't really get my husband to eat them. But I think when you've had them growing up, it's just, you're familiar with the taste and it tastes good.
So, side story about organ meat and growing up. We grew up vegetarians, and I went to my mom one day and I said that I wanted a steak. First of all, we didn't eat steak, and second of all, she couldn't really afford steak. We were, or you know, not exactly living in luxury when I was growing up. And so my mom decided the solution to this problem was to buy like CAFO liver from the grocery store and tell me that it was steak. So she cooks up this liver, and who knows what it was. Probably was like beef or pig liver, because, you know, it was like a big thing. It wasn't, you know, like a little chicken liver or whatever. I take a bite and I decide that it's disgusting. And she's like, yeah, this is steak, you know? And I'm like, I don't know what is wrong with my friends, but this is disgusting. I don't ever want to have this again. So, not all of us have had the privilege of being like welcomely introduced to organ meat. In fact, to this day, my very good friend and photographer, Amy, is constantly pushing me to try organ meats and to be more brave, because as much as we do it, I honestly don't really enjoy organ meat that much. So, Amy will tell me on Facebook the things that she's doing and trying with organ meat, and my mom, who follows us both, will pop in and be like, you guys are so gross!
So. I mean, I'm Armenian, and so, you know, we ate a lot of organ meats and stews and whatnot, but I remember, like, being embarrassed when I was young, because I thought it was weird, and I didn't want my friends to come over and smell the crazy stew my mom had brewing, you know, but I think, for me, liver's still the easiest. I mean, a lot of the other organ meats, or tongue, too, but a lot of the other organ meats, I still have a little bit of a hard time with, you know, even though I ate them growing up, because I didn't eat them all through my 20s, because I was also a vegetarian, so those are all, I'm kind of reintroducing these things as well.
Interestingly, I'm totally fine with tongue and heart, but it's the texture and the irony taste of liver that I have a difficult time. Like, I have to mix it with things. I can't just enjoy liver. So, okay. Speaking of liver, finally have a first foods question, right?
We do. This question is from Kelly. Hi, our daughter has finally begun eating solids. This is very exciting for us since she is disabled and it's taken 7 years. Eating like a champ too, with exceptions that she only eats pureed and bumpy consistencies. Looking on web, I find many recipes that use a lot of grains. Any resources that shy away from them?
Well, I would say there's a lot of purees and soups and stews on paleo recipes and websites. I know, RC, just in your book alone. I will go ahead and reveal that in Beyond Bacon, the way that we choose to use liver is in a delicious liver gravy, and I would highly recommend that as a nutrient-dense, smooth source. You can just, you don't have to look up my recipe for it, because you probably don't want to wait until July 2nd, but I do know that there are other paleo liver gravy recipes on the web that might be good. We have several recipes on our sites for purees and soups, including egg drop soup, would probably be a welcome thing for her. That's my kid's ultimately favorite recipe, and would probably be enjoyable for her. Matt will put a link to the show notes for those. RC, do you have any particular recipes that are coming to your mind that would be...
Well, I could tell her about some of the simple things I make for my daughter, but there's actually this great book that we love that we use. It's called Super Nutrition for Babies by Kelly Gelsinger, I think. And it's around $10 on Amazon, and we gift it to everyone that's pregnant. Because I don't know if you guys have seen this book, but I think it came out about last year, and the authors take a really nutrient-dense and mostly paleo approach to introducing solids, but it's full of recipes, and they're really well-informed on digestion and the healthy gut, and they outline foods to eat at different ages as well as recipes to go along with them. And I say it's mostly paleo because it's actually from a Weston A. Price background, but the authors really don't emphasize grains, and they really actually emphasize really waiting to introduce grains properly if you're going to. So the recipes are almost all paleo. So in there's actually some great organ meat recipes and just all kinds of kind of lumpy kind of baby food recipes that it seems like her daughter would like. But I just do simple, I mean, we just right now do kind of simple things, just puree some squash with ghee, or we saute liver in ghee and mix it with bone broth. Our daughter loves that. So, but I would say that book would be a great resource.
That sounds great. I haven't checked that out because I have not had a baby.
That's right.
We also... had this great, it was a baby food mill. So if you sort of look up on the Google or Amazon. The Google, sorry.
I hurt you.
The Google is a like total like longstanding joke in my family. So it's really hard for me to just say Google because, okay, I'm going to keep talking about the baby food mill. And it's basically this, column, you stick some food in, you push the bowl down while you crank a little crank, and then it pushes the food through, like, basically a meat grinder, but designed for softer food. And when my kids were sort of old enough that they had tried a lot of these foods, and we were fairly confident about them not having food sensitivities, we were able to start pureeing whatever was on the table that we were eating, and make, you know, a mix of whatever meat and vegetables we were eating and put it together for them. And it was, you know, all right in a little bowl. So that kind of helped, like, make a meal that you wouldn't necessarily, like, look at it and think that would taste great in a blender, but you could kind of make it sort of a thick puree right at the table, just a single serving. And I don't think they're very expensive. Mine was a gift, but I think
they're like $30. We had like one of those small food processors that I think is supposed to like chop onions that we just exclusively saved for baby foods. And I mean baby foods, not in the sense of we wouldn't like make baby foods, but we would take whatever there was from dinner that we couldn't reasonably mash with our fork, and we would just pulse it a couple of times in the food processor. And that seemed to go over really well, especially if you add in a couple of spoonfuls of like applesauce or some sort of sweeter food, because they're used to eating, specifically if it's babies. I know this might not be the case for a 7-year-old. I'm not quite sure what she's been having so far, but breast milk is naturally pretty sweet. And so when they move to first foods, and we've also talked about before how they don't have the amylase to break down more fibrous and carbohydrate rich, specifically vegetables, adding a little sweetener to it can be encouraging for them to want to continue to eat. Did I get all that right?
Sounded good to me.
I get nervous talking about scientific things because I'm like, oh, I just totally told someone the wrong thing. Okay.
All right. Our next question is from Elisa from Farmington. Okay. Sorry. It's obviously late. New York. Hi there. I'm a huge fan of your podcast and really appreciate all you do. I'm writing to ask for some advice about my 6-month-old son's diet. Just some brief background. My son has been breastfed since birth, induced at 42 weeks. About 2 months, he developed several problems, full body rashes, really high IgE levels, problems with weight gain, vomiting, frequent foul smelling, green stools. He was diagnosed with a milk and soy allergy, and the doctor had me start adding Nutrimigen, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, formula for kids with dairy allergy to his extracted breast milk. I was told not to eat dairy or soy as well. This wasn't a problem because I eat mostly paleo, but had been using butter, so this was a minor change. He started to do a lot better after we made these changes, though he is still underweight. We were starting to add solids, and I need a little guidance. I've been trying to follow Chris Kresser's Healthy Baby Code plan, but it feels like nearly everything I try in terms of nutrient-dense foods causes problems. Example, he has had pretty severe reactions to both egg yolks and cod liver oil. Right now, he is only eating avocados, bananas, and pears. I should say as well that I have very severe allergies. I am hopeful my son doesn't have to go through everything I've been through. I am looking for some advice about how to introduce new foods to a young infant who seems to be really prone to allergies. Could it be that he needs gut healing at such a young age? Any help you can offer would be greatly appreciated.
So I think, you know, we have talked about some of the nutrient-dense foods, but we'll talk maybe a little bit more about some of the lesser allergenic ones that we might recommend. But it is possible that Alyssa is passing on these allergies through her breast milk. I know for me, my children could not tolerate dairy at all in the breast milk. And as soon as they were mostly weaned, not even fully weaned, like let's say a year to 18 months when it was really only like an occasional nursing, comfort nursing, night nursing, things like that, they actually were eating dairy with no problem themselves, but had an extreme reaction to it through my breast milk, and that's because I was allergic. We've come to obviously find out that they're not as fine with dairy as we thought they were, but not the kind of reaction that you're talking about or that I would have from it. So I would say the things that you seem to have tried are on the allergen list. Even though egg yolks and cod liver oil are nutrient dense and really good, I also know that Chris Kresser's daughter, when he introduced egg yolks in the beginning, did not do very well with them. He moved on and a couple of months later tried them again and it worked okay. And cod is a fish, and fish is a top 8 allergen as well. So I would suggest keeping to things off of the allergen list in general until you can get a sense for what your baby tolerates and does well on. Avocados is really great. I know bananas is one of the few recommended fruits in the beginning. I think apples and pears are okay too. I can't remember, but some of the more adventurous fruits you don't want to do too much of because the carbohydrate content in them is difficult for babies to break down. We did liver a lot in the beginning. Like my kids, when they were babies, even though we weren't paleo, I knew that liver was a nutrient dense food. Ironic that I like knew that for babies, but didn't eat it myself. So we would go to the store and buy liver and then just make it for the baby. And like, we wouldn't eat it. We would be like, oh, it's so gross. I can't believe they're eating that, but they loved it. And that should
what
be
kind of, what kind of, did you do chicken liver? Or
yeah, I did I did chicken liver. And of course it wasn't pastured because I didn't know better, but pastured chicken liver is pretty, well, all liver is really affordable. And what you want to do, the reason chicken liver I found was the best was because it kind of crumbled when you cooked it. Whereas as an adult, we try to cook liver the least amount as possible because if it's still pink in the middle, it has more of a tender texture that's palatable. But for babies, we cooked it all the way through till it was kind of hard and crumbly. And then they just were able to pincer grasp the liver into their mouth like little nuggets. And because it has that kind of grainy texture, it just melted in their mouth. They didn't need to really chew it a lot. And frankly, we just did liver and avocados and bananas for, I'd say, a month. And then we moved on to roasted foods because we could roast and then puree them. And what we would do is we would alter our dinner meals. We went from having kind of grandiose or, you know, whatever dinner meals we were having to either, you know, roasting our vegetables. And then we would, like I said, you know, pulse it a couple times in the food processor if it wasn't mushy for them. But what we found personally is that because roasting creates a natural caramelization and a kind of sweeter taste, the babies were more amenable to giving that a try. So vegetables in general should have no problem. They're not on the allergen list. Of course, if there's gut issues, they could be, you know, FODMAP intolerant, but I can't imagine that that's super prevalent in 6-month-olds that have been breastfed. I turn it over to you guys.
That was great. I mean, I would just add just a couple things. It sounds like maybe having some digestive problems, I might consider adding a probiotic. I know Chris Kresser recommends the infant formula from Claire Labs. It might just be something to look into. And I would say go really slow with solids if the baby's not reacting that well, you know, so you could really observe and see what the baby's reacting to. Because like Chris's daughter, my daughter at first with egg yolks got like a little dry skin and rashy, and I stopped it for a while and it went away, and then we introduced it again and she was fine with it. So maybe it's just her digestive system had to catch up. And then maybe I think bone broth might be a good thing to try because, you know, it's really soothing to the GI tract, and if the baby could even have a few spoonfuls a day, that might be helpful.
Yeah, I was actually going to say probiotics too, but I was going to recommend, since she's still nursing, that she take probiotics because that is actually going to be passed through the breast milk. And so what I was actually going to say is it may be really, really helpful for her to focus on her health, because a lot of these problems might still be through things that are passing through breast milk. So
yeah, absolutely.
I would say taking a really high quality probiotic herself. I've been using Prescript Assist for about 8 months and it's really fantastic. And I've noticed that in the last month or so, Chris Kresser has been really promoting Prescript Assist as well, which I think is really cool because I'm like, I've already been taking that. So that's not one to give to your baby, but that's one to take yourself, and then those probiotics will be passed through. And then the other thing that she might want to look at is, I would look at nightshades in her diet as being like the next potential culprit for something that's activating the immune system, especially tomatoes, that's activating her immune system and contributing to her allergies. And potentially passing like IgE antibodies onto her baby. So that, I mean, you could go full autoimmune protocol. I think that's a great idea for this kind of level of allergy, because even though it's you know, developed for people with autoimmune disease, immune diseases have a lot in common with autoimmune diseases, and all of the same principles apply. So when you're looking at foods that are a problem in autoimmune disease, those foods tend to also be a problem in immune diseases. So whatever she can do to help help her own allergies, are it's going to improve the quality of her breast milk and going to be helping heal her baby's gut. And broth, that was an awesome suggestion.
Totally. I think one of the other things that I was reminded of from what Arcee said is there's absolutely nothing that says a six-month-old has to start solids. When Cole was a baby, he didn't start solids till he was 8 months old, and he ate avocados, bananas, lima beans, which I wish I could undo, and liver exclusively for that first month, because that's what he liked, and we were totally fine to just keep those things around, and they were easy to kind of dice up. He could chew on them. They didn't bother him. Pincer grasp, and it wasn't until he was 9 months old that he started to actually eat, and at that point it was so much easier to introduce solids when you can give a baby a spoon or a fork and they have the capability to kind of use it or to use their pincer grasp. These are cues for knowing when a baby is ready for solids. We haven't really talked about it. I know I probably talked about it in the last podcast, but it's important that your baby be able to sit up straight to hold their own weight, because posture is important for digestion, so they need to be able to sit up on their own. They need to have a pincer grasp, which means they need to be able to pick up something food specific that you're giving them and put it in their own mouth, and they need to have a proper swallow. If they've been nursing or bottle feeding for so long and you go to give them food and they thrust it back out at you, oftentimes that's because their tongue hasn't developed into the pattern to be able to swallow backwards. Instead, they're flowing forwards, which is what they do to pull milk out of a breast. So if those things aren't happening yet, then don't feel compelled to give your baby food. There's absolutely nothing that says that they need it. In fact, the reason that you're able to give them only avocados or only bananas for a whole month is because your breast milk is supplying 100% of the nutrition that they need. And so it's really an augment. Think of this time period as like an introduction and augment to the breast milk. It is not intended to replace the breast milk until much later, when they're eating, you know, whole balanced meals that are nutrient dense. And that's why most babies naturally wean between 1 and 2 years, because that's when they, well, American babies, that's when they take on nourishing themselves rather than from breast milk, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a great point, Stacey, because I actually see this just in my community often, where people are pretty rushed to introduce foods. And I actually saw a report, a CDC report, that people are introducing foods too soon and babies aren't quite ready, even as early as 4 months. They're finding is pretty common. So I think that's a really good point, that you could just wait till your baby's ready and you'll know, you'll see the signs, you'll see them getting excited when they see you eating and whatnot.
Yeah. Finn was the opposite of Cole. He was literally screaming, gimme, gimme, when he was 4 months old and we were sitting at the table. I think he had bananas for like 2 months straight, because we just put it in one of those mesh baggies just to keep him quiet. He's always been so advanced. Okay.
So our last question is from Alicia from Columbia. Is that Missouri?
Yes, that's Missouri. I knew that one. I'm so proud of myself. Pat on the back.
At least I can, like, blame my Canadian-ness for not knowing all of them. Okay. My soon-to-be 9-month-old has had constipation issues since around 2 months of age. The doctor tried having us put her on soy formula. I was highly against it, and it made my daughter's constipation worse. We switched to a low-lactose formula, and she continues to have constipation. Is there any advice on ways to help her diet? I don't want to put her on Miralax. Since coming across your awesome podcast last week, I've decided to get her off the baby cereals. We were not doing an organic formula and are switching her to that. We made some Vietnamese pho broth and make bone soup. I'm trying to get her to eat a little of that. Any other thoughts? Her poop never changes colors with what she eats, but stays a dark greenish color. Thank you for your insight.
Oh. I know, Sarah, you're more familiar with this topic. I just want to give a high five to... I'm sorry.
I know constipation.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area for you. high five on the, you know, not wanting to put her on soy formula, trying to figure out other things, making bone broth soup, switching around cereals. These are all really good things that you're doing. And, you know, high five for following your instincts and trying to do those things. I know probably going to talk about it, but since we haven't mentioned it so far, there is a recipe for making your own formula on the Weston A. Price Foundation's website. We can put a link in the show notes. And that might be something that you want to check out if you're not happy with the formula that she's
taking. Have like three or four different
variety.
Recipes. I had a very similar experience with my oldest. She, from pretty close to birth, was very irregular, and she would poop every 5, 6, 7 days. She once spent 9 days, and then when she would, they'd be very thick, and it would be an emergency. It would, wherever you were, everything would be covered. It was good times. We never really... She was exclusively breastfed, and I'm sure that was a reaction to foods that I was eating, because this was still in my Oreo cookie binge days. This was long before paleo. So then when she started solids, we started her with rice cereal, and that made it much, much worse. And we ended up, it became this constant... you know, over the next year and a half, this constant struggle of, you know, giving her what we called poop fruits. So we were always giving her these sort of high sugar alcohol fruits, like, you know, apples and pears and peaches and prunes, to try and get her to poop. And it became, you know, this this really challenging thing. She became very underweight, and around the time we started potty training, we did put her on Miralax. She was on Miralax for 2 years until we went paleo. And then within a month of just being gluten-free, she was completely off Miralax, and she was on a scoop a day. I mean, that's an adult dose. I mean, that's a huge dose of Miralax. And so within a month of just removing gluten from her diet, and she was still eating rice at that point, she was completely off Miralax. And then going grain-free, and then going dairy-free, and you know, the full paleo experience that we are now, went from, you know, sort of barely being okay without Miralax to, like, she's just a completely normal kid, and she has regular bowel movements that are, you know, perfect consistency, and I'm sure she would love that I'm sharing this with the world.
I often think that. I'm like, oh, my poor kids.
So, you know, in my personal experience, with her, with her body, and with my own body, I had chronic constipation for 12 years before, for 12 years diagnosed as irritable bowel syndrome. I mean, my mother will tell you I had it all my life. And that she has, you know, these really acute memories of me as a little baby working so hard to push poops out that were rock hard, because I was, you know, constipated my whole life. And it was when I went paleo, and for me, it was really critical to take out grains and dairy products out of my diet. That was when, suddenly I didn't have to take, you know, stool softeners and laxatives, which I had been taking for 12 years. And within 2 weeks of going paleo, I was able to stop those things. I mean, that for me was my huge dramatic, holy smokes, I need to tell every single person I know about how great paleo is and I'll start a blog. I mean, that was why, that was why I'm here now is because of the difference that paleo made to my ability to poop. So I totally think you are on the right track of, moving your daughter to nutrient dense foods. I mean, baby cereals really don't have much nutrition to offer except for some iron and some B vitamins that are added in. And those are, you know, vitamins that you can, and minerals you can get from all kinds of great foods. And we've spent a whole show talking about, really, really good foods. I think broth is a great idea. And I think that also making sure that you're, even though your daughter's probably still breastfeeding, to be offering a little bit of water with meals to make sure that you're getting that water content with meals, into her diet as well is probably going to make a big, big difference.
I would agree with the water. I found that adding a tablespoon to like 3 ounces worth of water of apple juice helped my children want water. And then I just kind of stopped adding juice after they got used to drinking water, like maybe a couple of weeks. But it was really important as they kind of transitioned to that 9 to 12 month period where they start eating more foods that they have something, you know, to be offered other than just milk all the time, especially if someone's constipated and not hydrated enough. That's a good idea.
Arcee, do you have anything?
Just a couple of little things. This might be another good case to find some high-quality probiotics. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to say, so which is so awesome that she's decided to get the baby off cereal and introduce more nutrient-dense foods. It's really, really wonderful. And she mentioned that she did a fa broth. And as the baby's having digestive problems, the only thing I would say there is whenever I've made that broth, I put a lot of spices and it's really flavorful. So maybe it'd be best to start out with a more simple broth, just bones, filtered water, apple cider vinegar, not too much other stuff in there, just in case the baby's just sensitive to maybe a lot of the different spices that might be in that broth in particular.
Good call.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so, but yeah, that's the only comments I have.
But I would say to you that the best measure of health in anyone's baby, when you're talking about that like 0 to 12 month period in particular, but even your toddlers when you're wiping their booties on the toilet, is excretion. And the fact that her poop never changes and it's always a dark greenish color is concerning. I think there's a poop parade section of Practical Paleo if you don't have that already, and the idea of looking at those poops and thinking about what poop should like look like would be helpful, but also keeping in mind that when a baby's diet is mainly liquid, i.e. breast milk, formula, water, it's going to be a looser stool, but still the idea of color and making sure that there aren't food chunks and those kinds of things are really important. Is that a show? We ended on poop?
We ended on poop. Liz and Diane would be proud.
Yay, we mentioned poop. I think more than once. Cool. Well, Arcee, thank you so much for joining us. I'm totally impressed with your awesome knowledge bombs on this topic, and I'm super glad that you were able to join us. I know we had to reschedule from yesterday, and I really appreciate you being accommodating with us. I can hear your little one waiting to spend quality time with you. So thanks for taking the time to join us today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me. It was so much fun. I love talking about this stuff. I could talk about it all day. So it was my pleasure to be on.
And for those of you who have made it through this podcast, obviously you can see that Arcee is very knowledgeable when it comes to nutrient density. And that's exactly what I was trying to say about her book in the beginning, is that she really incorporates a lot of these philosophies into her paleo slow cooker book that you must check out. So,
oh, thank you.
Cool. Well, thanks ladies. And Sarah, talk to you next week.
Yeah. Talk to you next week. Good night, everybody.
Hey, good night.
If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
So what happens when you take a week off podcasting? I forget to...